My name is Harlene Hain, and I have the great privilege of being the Vice Chancellor here at the University of Otago. It's fantastic to see so many people here today. As usual, I would like to extend a very warm welcome to the staff and the students from the University of Otago. But I'd also like to extend a very warm welcome to members of the community who are also here this evening, because I know that this is a great opportunity for you to take a look inside about some of the things that make this university so fantastic. The other thing I want to mention, of course, is that like all really important events in our lives, there are usually family and friends in the audience. And I would like to warmly welcome David's wife, Denise Casey, who is here this evening. And I would also, there she is, I would also like to welcome some of David's very good friends, Ian and Maria Griffin, who are also here to support him. And just by way of a slight digression, it's fantastic to have Ian here with us because the relationship between the university and the museum has never been stronger. And it was a fantastic opportunity for me about 2 weeks ago to be at Ian's shop and actually celebrate the opening of the new planetarium. So if any of you have not had a chance to see this fantastic new facility that is literally right on our doorstep, I would strongly encourage you to do so. And I'm sure that Ian will be sticking around for drinks after David's talk, and I'm sure he would love to tell you more about that fantastic development. So welcome, Ian. Now back to the man of the hour, who is Professor David Hutchinson. And that's why we are all gathered here this evening, is to celebrate David's promotion to professor. And as I remind people every time I give one of these introductions, the path to professor at the University of Otago is a very difficult one with extraordinarily exacting standards. And like everyone who has stood at this podium before him, Professor David Hutchinson has excelled in teaching, in service, and in research. In terms of teaching, David's teaching portfolio is actually extraordinarily broad. He has taught high school students in Thailand. He has taught across the curriculum here at the University of Otago, from first-year students through to PhD students, and he's also taught at the University of the Third Age as well. So from the very youngest to the most senior students, David has excelled in his ability to share his knowledge with others. He's also exhibited outstanding service, service to the university in terms of his position as the Associate Dean of Research in the Division of Sciences. He's also been on the Division of Sciences Promotion Committee. He was one of the founding members of and the convener of Ozone, which is our group of highly successful early career academics. And I'm also very happy to say he was also on the panel that selected me as the Vice Chancellor here, so I'm deeply indebted to him. David has also shown outstanding service to New Zealand science through his work with the Royal Society of New Zealand, and he's the past president of the Otago Institute. And internationally, he's also excelled in his service. He is a founding member of the Global Young Academy, a group formed to address the issues of importance to early career scientists. And in 2008, David was actually nominated by the Academy Council of the Royal Society of New Zealand to represent New Zealand at the World Economic Forum. And he was then invited to act as a mentor in that group in 2009. But we're all gathered here tonight to hear about David's research. He is one of the world's leading authorities in the simulation of ultra-cold Bose gases. He's the former director of the Jack Dodd Center for Quantum Technology. And recently, he was successful with his team in a bid for a Center for Research Excellence, where he is now the inaugural director of the Dodd Walls Center for Photonic and Quantum Technologies. I will leave more of a description of Professor Hutchinson's research to Professor Keith Hunter, but it leaves me just to congratulate you, David, on your promotion to professor. It was very richly deserved, and I, for one, am very much looking forward to what we have in store for us this evening. I will now hand over the microphone to Professor Keith Hunter, who is the Pro-Vice Chancellor of the Division of Sciences, and he will tell us just a little bit more about David's journey to professor.
Thank you, Vice Chancellor. And may I add to that it's my pleasure to introduce all of the new professors in science, and I'm happy to say that's been an arduous task over the last 6 years because there have been so many of them, amongst which, of course, David is the latest worthy recipient. So as the Vice-Chancellor mentioned, David is Director of the Dodd Wall Centre for Photonics and Quantum Technologies, and we were delighted when this Centre of Research Excellence was selected in the round a couple of years ago. David is a theoretical quantum physicist, and he began his career at Exeter University and followed that up by postdoc positions in Dublin and then at Queen's University in Canada. From Canada, he went back to the UK to take up a lectureship in physics at Somerville College, Oxford, and to do research in the famous Clarendon Laboratory. It was during his tenure at Oxford that he came across Dan Walls, of the Dodd Wall Centre, of course, and through funding from the Royal Society of London, he came to New Zealand, and ultimately moving to Otago in the year 2000. In 2003, David received the inaugural Carl Smith Medal for Emerging Researchers and the Rohes Trust Award. As the Vice-Chancellor has mentioned, he was convener of Ozone, which is the group of early career award winners. He was a member of the Council of the Royal Society of New Zealand. I remember that well because I was also a member of the Council. And he was instrumental in developing the Global Young Academy. Now that David's older, he's still not too old to continue one of his other activities, which is swimming. And apparently he used to be quite good at that. In fact, he's got over 30 New Zealand Masters Games medals for swimming, most of them gold. He also picked up 8th place in the 2009 Sydney World Masters Games. And one of his colleagues in the Global Young Academy noted soon after that at a meeting in Berlin that that wasn't bad for someone with the body of Winnie the Pooh. And so we anticipate good things from the Auckland World Masters Games in 2017 from David as our Otago representative. So all joking aside, David, congratulations on your thoroughly deserved promotion, and I now invite you to present your inaugural professorial lecture.
I'd just like to add to that and say that that probably says a little bit more about the calibre of the New Zealand Masters Games swimming than it does about me. I really need to not have the body of Winnie the Pooh if I'm going to do very well in Auckland in 2017. Today I'd like to talk to you about how curiosity doesn't kill the cat. So this is obviously an allusion to quantum mechanics and the famous Schrödinger's cat, but it's also, I would say, what's driven me through this process, and that's curiosity. I think almost everything I've done is based on pure curiosity, and I've been very lucky to pursue a career where just by studying what interests you has led to a certain level of success. And I'm very grateful for the environment around me that supports that sort of inquisitive nature. But I realize that there are a number of experts in the audience who know probably more about quantum physics than I do. But I realize also that there are a number of people who know nothing about quantum mechanics in the audience. And so I'm going to try and spend some time giving you a flavor of what quantum physics is about, why it's rather different to our classical intuition. When I mean classical, I mean the physics that we grow up with at high school, the mechanics of particles, billiard balls, if you like. And then I'm going to try and argue that it's the mechanics that has sort of seduced us into a way of viewing physics that I think leads to a lot of the problems mentally that we have about quantum physics, and then hopefully you'll take away a flavor of quantum physics and not see it quite as, let's say, mystical as a lot of people try and make out. So the whole thing really starts with Sir Isaac Newton. So some 200 odd, 300 years ago. And so Isaac Newton, and the reason I use the pound note here, of course, is everyone knows that Isaac Newton not only was an amazing physicist, but he also rationalised the British Mint. And so he was the person who chaired the Mint for a long period of time. But Newton's laws really reigned supreme for 200 years. Okay, so Newton came up with we've all studied them at school. So a mechanistic way in which particles move. If we apply a force, then we have an acceleration for that particle. If we apply no force, there's no acceleration. There, if a particle is moving and we have a trajectory, we know its velocity, we know its position, we know all the forces that act on it, then we can plot out that trajectory ad infinitum, and we know exactly where the particle is. And it's completely mechanistic. And so Alexander Pope, friend of Isaac Newton's, wrote of Newton, "Nature and nature's laws lay hid in night. God said, let Newton be, and all was light." So we end up in a situation where we now understand sort of everything, right? We can start making predictions about what's going to happen. We understand gravitation. He talks about optics. We understand optics. There's lots of stuff that Newton understood. And there was just a little bit of trouble with some of the details, okay? So one thing that we knew, James Clerk Maxwell wrote down the laws of electromagnetism. And so he was the person who gave us this sort of unified theory of how electricity and magnetism work. He's the first person to write down a set of equations that really described electricity and magnetism. And one of the consequences that just fell out of that was that if you have an electric field, magnetic field, there's an oscillatory solution to these equations, so that there's an electric field that wiggles, which goes together with a magnetic field that wiggles. And this wiggling wave propagates with a very well-defined speed. And when he calculated what that speed was the speed of light. And so he naturally concluded that light was an electromagnetic wave. Okay? So this is a huge breakthrough. And one of the consequences of that was that if you actually work out what the energy of the wave was, and also you could work out from these electric fields what force would act on a body. And so from Newton's laws, if you've got a force acting, you get a change of momentum. So if I get a change of momentum of the body, that must mean that the light has got some momentum. Okay, so he was the first person to work out what the momentum of light was. And so he was able to write down this expression that the energy associated with light was just equal to the momentum of the light times the speed of the light. This is something now we associate with relativity. And in fact, there was the problem that I'm alluding to, the trouble in the details, is that it didn't really matter what frame of reference you were looking at this light in. It always had the same speed. So if you were on a train moving very fast and you looked at an experiment and there was emitted light and you measured how fast the light was moving relative to you, it would be moving at this speed of light that was predicted by his theory. If you were on the train, on the platform watching the train go by, instead of like Newton's laws where you'd have had a speed of something, if I threw a ball, I would see the ball move at a certain speed, the person on the train platform would see the ball move at a speed plus the speed of the train. In the case of the person on the platform, in this case for electromagnetism, they would see the light at the same speed, and this is kind of weird, right? So this is the origin of special relativity, Einstein's special relativity. And what Einstein did was really just take this idea seriously, that the speed of light was the same in every frame of reference, whether you were on the train or whether you were on the platform. So already in the middle of the 19th century, this problem was there. Okay, and in fact, Einstein's paper in 1905 was the title of the paper, although in German, was on the electrodynamics of moving bodies. So it was the resolution of this problem that Einstein's special theory of relativity solved. So there was a little bit of a problem there, but which needed relativity to solve. The reason I talk about that for a little while, though, is because I'm going to need that E is equal to P times C. I am going to have a few equations. I'm sorry. I'm told in public talks you're never to have any equations, but I'm a theorist. I can't do that. And so there are a few equations, but I promise you that every calculation is a back-of-the-envelope calculation, all right? They're all simple calculations. So let's remember that one, though. The energy is equal to the momentum times the speed for light. Okay, it's not true for a cricket ball. Cricket ball, we know that the kinetic energy of a cricket ball is half mv squared. So the mass times the velocity is the momentum. So that's p squared. It goes as p squared over 2m. But let's not worry about that. It's just different. Okay, Max Planck. Another detail. Max Planck he was a really old guy, right? Like when he came up with this, it was on the 14th of December 1900. He was already 40. Right? It's ancient for a physicist, a mathematician or a theoretical physicist. Actually, the sort of Nobel Prize equivalent for mathematics, you're not even allowed to get it if you're over 40, all right, because you're considered so ancient. So he was in some ways a conservative, okay? From the old school of physics, all right? But he was considering this problem to do with radiation. And if you take a black body, let's take a poker, right? And you stick a poker in the fire. If you leave it in there for a while, it glows red. If you heat it up, then it glows, let's say, white. And then eventually, if you get it really hot, it glows blue, right? So you start off at the red end of the spectrum. There's a peak in the radiation that's coming off of it, the peak in the light that's at the red end. If you make it hotter and hotter, the peak moves further and further to the blue end of the spectrum. So we can see sort of red, low energy, blue, high energy. So red, cold, blue, hot, right? So just normal logical stuff that we... okay. So the bluer and bluer you get, the hotter it gets, okay? If you take Newton's laws or Maxwell's laws, a sort of classical picture, and do the calculation for what should be the intensity of the light coming off of a poker at a given temperature, the red end you get right, okay? It's all perfect, everything fits, the red end fits. At the blue end, though, the amount of light that you should get just keeps going up and up and up. And obviously, if the poker glows red and then later glows blue if I make it hotter, there must be a peak, so it's got to go up and then come down. And the fact that our classical physics didn't come down was called the ultraviolet catastrophe, because everything goes wrong when you get down to the ultraviolet end of the spectrum. So, another detail. But what Planck figured out was, if I only allow energy to come in little packets, then the packets of energy are proportional to the frequency, then so the energy goes up, gets bigger as the frequency goes up, then it means it's less and less likely to make big packets of energy, and so that can kill off the tail in the ultraviolet end of the spectrum. But the issue is, he then said, well, what's going to be the relationship between the energy and the frequency? What's the size of these packets? And he said, well, the packets have to come in bits that are just proportional to the frequency. So the frequency is how fast the wave wiggles. So blue stuff wiggles faster than red stuff. So the packets for the blue end are bigger, but this quantity H, which we now call Planck's constant, was ridiculously tiny. It's 10 to the minus 34 in sort of our everyday units, joule seconds are the units that this comes in. So ridiculously tiny. So let's just think about what it means for a minute. Let's take a step back. I've got a small child. She loves going on a swing. Let's say the swing. Let's say if I push Nancy, my daughter, on a swing, she oscillates at about 1 hertz. Let's say, just to make the maths easy. So let's imagine H was a big number, about 1, right? Sort of a number the same as everyday units. Then what that would mean is that the amplitude of the oscillation of Nancy on the swing could only come in certain discrete steps. So if I pushed her, nothing would happen until I pushed her enough to give her enough energy so that I could have one quantum, one packet of energy. And then she'd oscillate with a height difference of, let's say, 10 centimeters. I haven't done the quick calculation, but I think that's probably about right. Okay? And then if I keep pushing, She won't oscillate, she'll just oscillate with that amplitude until I give enough energy, and then she'll oscillate with 20 centimetres amplitude and so on. Okay? So there's only discrete values at which she'd oscillate. But of course, H is not 1, it's 10 to the minus 34. So those differences in amplitude are like 10 to the minus 36 of a metre, which is much less than, say, much less than the diameter of an atom. So we can never measure any of this. So we never, ever see this in our everyday lives. But when we come to talk about things that have got frequency of 10 to the 9 hertz or, 1,000 billion hertz or whatever, then 1,000 million hertz, then we can start to see these effects. So when we go to the subatomic world, we can see this, and Planck used this to explain what was going on in this ultraviolet catastrophe and explain away this ultraviolet catastrophe. And he won the Nobel Prize in 1918 for this. So incredible for an ancient man to win this. So as I said, calculations are all back of the envelope calculations. So let's take that energy of Planck's, that the energy is equal to Planck's constant times the frequency. Let's pick one of these. Okay, so we've got the energy is Planck's constant times the frequency. Now, I said we've got the frequency, that's how fast something wiggles. Okay, this is how the wavelength, how far something moves when it wiggles. So if I've got something that moves that distance every time it wiggles, the number of wiggles times how far it moves with each wiggle gives us the number of wiggles per second times how far it moves with each wiggle gives us the speed. Okay, all right. Rate of wiggling times distance when you wiggle. And we can put these together and we can get an expression based on that Maxwell's equation that relates momentum to the wavelength of light. So this is another thing that tells us these little packets of energy also come with little packets of momentum. Okay. So one of the wonderful things about giving this last lecture is that the technicians have just changed all of the system for the lecture theatres. So I have to hope that I can figure out how to actually run this. Excellent. Okay. Yes. Okay, so I'm sorry, I really tried to do a proper experiment for this, but I couldn't get something to work very well. And so this is actually now going to take that idea that light comes in little packets of energy. Okay, it's called the photoelectric effect. Now, what I've got here is I've got a plate. So this is a cathode, okay, and an anode. And so this, I'm going to put a voltage across this, if I can find the right, turn on a voltage. So I'm putting a voltage on my battery. So this means there's an electric charge across here. So I've put a negative charge on here, a positive charge on here. And I'm going to shine some light on. And the light, when I shine the light on, the light has enough energy to kick out these electrons. And so once the electrons get kicked out of the metal, they get accelerated by the potential and they fly across here. Easy, everyone understands this, all right? It's just energy coming from electromagnetic radiation. Energy gets dumped in the metal, it kicks out electrons, and all that happens is more intensity, more current, less intensity, less current, all right? All easy, everyone understood that, Maxwell understood that. But if the light is red with the same intensity, according to electromagnetism, the same amount of energy is being dumped into this metal, and yet we get no electrons out. And no one understood what was happening. And so what Einstein did was say he took Planck's idea and said, well, hold on, Planck said that light can only come in little chunks of energy which are proportional to the frequency of the light. In the red light, there are just more photons, more particles, we now call those particles, those packets of light, photons, the more packets of light here than there were when I had this in the UV, so at a higher frequency, lower wavelength. So the total amount of energy is the same whether it's purple or whether it's red, but now each individual packet doesn't have enough energy to kick an electron out of this metal. Okay, so an electron, it sits in here, it absorbs a packet of energy from this red light, it wiggles around a bit, and then gets rid of it, and it still stays in the metal. But if we turn the energy up, turn the frequency of the light up, then it's got enough energy to kick these out. So this is actually what Einstein got his Nobel Prize for. He didn't get his Nobel Prize for relativity. He didn't get it for Brownian motion, which he also solved in that year. He got his Nobel Prize for explaining this photoelectric effect. So what this is saying, it's confirming Planck's idea that light comes in little packets. So light is an electromagnetic wave, but it's also made up of little packets of light, and hence those little packets of light are almost like particles of light. And if I just turn the lights down a little bit, if I can figure out how to do that. Is that working? No. Ah, yeah. That's the one. So, see, I've got this red laser pointer here, and this is a bit of photosensitive paper. So these are all about 5 milliwatts, right? The laser pointers aren't allowed to be any stronger than that by New Zealand law. So here's a red one. Nothing happens on this. But here's a green laser pointer and brute force. If brute force doesn't work, you need more brute force. So there. Okay? That's basically the same thing that's going on up here, right? The amount of energy in the particles of light of this blue end of the spectrum is enough to excite the energy on this fluorescent piece of paper, and so the excitation is what you see left behind fluorescing. But the red, still just as intense, but the energy in the green light is not enough. The energy in the red light is not enough. Okay? So I'm sorry I couldn't really do the photoelectric effect, but that's about as close as I could get. Thank you to Ian Griffin for the loan of the very expensive laser pointer that I, as an academic, can't afford. And as a board member at the Otago Museum, I need to check how much he's getting paid. So did I. So, okay. So where are I? Oh, right. So I want to... I've still got that one up there. Let's go back. So... if I can fly this, perfect. Okay, now this chap here is de Broglie. Now, a French physicist and mathematician. Now, it's very easy to get a Nobel Prize in physics, okay? And I just want to show you what de Broglie got his Nobel Prize for. So remember that we had that momentum was related to wavelength. So that was kind of giving the momentum is equal to Planck's constant divided by the wavelength. So this is giving a wave-like stuff, giving particle-like properties, the momentum. It's kind of giving particle-like properties to a wave. Now, what de Broglie did, he took P is H over lambda, and he thought, ha-ha. So you can see, I'll just take you through it slowly. He divided both sides by P and multiplied both sides by lambda. And so if you work through that, you get lambda is H over P. So he got the Nobel Prize for this. Okay? So, but of course, what he got the Nobel Prize for was not his high-powered mathematics, but the interpretation of what he was doing in that mathematics. And so the thought is that if momentum can be given to light, why can't I give wave-like properties to particles? So why is there something special about light? Is there something special about waves? And of course not. So I was very lucky to grow up in this beautiful place, Dorset. I tried very hard to be a geologist, but they wouldn't let me. I don't know how you can grow up on the Jurassic Coast without wanting to be a geologist. My issue was I wanted to do geology, maths, chemistry, and biology as my A-levels, but you can't do geology and mathematics at the same time. Like, they just don't let you. It's, you know, because geologists obviously don't like mathematics or whatever. I don't understand why. But they said, if you want to do geology, you don't need geology A-level. Just do physics, because you'll learn much more doing physics than you will geology. And then you can go and be a geologist. So I did physics at A-level, and then I was useless at it, and I found it really hard. So that sort of piqued my interest, my curiosity, and that's why I carried on doing physics. But I'm not showing these for the geology of the one foot. Like, this is Lulworth Cove on the left-hand side. So I actually did my O-level geography project on Lulworth Cove. But what you can see here... I'll use the green one, I think. What you can see here is we've got the waves coming in, and you can see the waves being diffracted off of this slit, all right? So this is a single-slit diffraction experiment, okay? So that's why it's interesting, right? And you can see that the way it cuts out the cove behind. Okay, you've got soft rock behind, whatever, but I don't want to go into the geology, but it's... you get these nice diffraction patterns. And then I took this photo. This is about two bays over, right? If you walk up the hill here, you get to Durdle Door, which is lovely. There's a pub about here. You walk over the hill, and you get to Durdle Door, and then the next bay over is this, which is Man of War Bay. And so what I was trying to see here is I remember this as being much more sort of closing off this bay, and then I was hoping for a diffraction, a two-slit diffraction experiment, but unfortunately it didn't work. Oh, you can see something interesting happening down here, but anyway, can't really see it. But let's go back to my little Java applet so we can see something there. Let's get rid of that one. Ooh. Maybe, go on, let me. Let's get rid of that one. And we'll try this one. So here I've got another little Java applet, and I want to put a slit in here and put it up there so you can see it and have a screen. Okay, so it's a little bit difficult to see, but here we've got a light source, and so here we've got Man O' War Bay, okay, so with a little barrier, and then so we've got two slits, and so what's happening here is I've got light that's going through two slits. And so if I've got basically two sources of waves now, but the wave fronts coming from here and here are basically the same because they came from the same source. So then when they come and get to this point, these two guys have traveled the same distance, so I get constructive interference. But this guy has gone a little bit further than this guy getting to this point on the screen. So when I get a peak from here, I get a trough from here, or actually the very... the lowest trough, and they cancel out, and so I get destructive interference. I get constructive, destructive. So this is an intrinsically wave phenomenon. It happens in Man O' War Bay, or it should do if nature would only let me have a demonstration from this beautiful place, but it happens for any wave phenomenon. But it's an intrinsically wave phenomenon. You only get this interference pattern if you have a wave. If you have just particles, an individual particle going through here, and an individual particle going through here, there's nothing to interfere. There's no wave to interfere, so I can't get an interference pattern. All right, now under here, I can't touch it because it took forever to get it to work properly. But what I've got here is actually there's a laser diode source, and there's something to split that into two beams and then two mirrors, and it brings that beam back together. So this is underneath in this box here. You can come and have a look afterwards, right? And you'll be able to see all the apparatus that sets it up. It's a very nice demonstration that was built by Eil Schwarz, who should be here. He's at the back. It's a wonderful demonstration. So I do encourage you to come and see it. It's also on display in the Einstein exhibition in the museum, so I encourage you to go over and see that exhibition and see it there. But what we can see here is an interference pattern. So this is from a Michelson interferometer. So it's beautiful laser interference pattern. Okay, so the next thing I want to go on to is some real experimental data. So here, I'll start this off. So we've got a movie on the right here. And so what this is an experiment done at a Hitachi where these are electrons, all right? So electrons are being, basically, they're doing the same two-slit experiment. So, but they're done at the point where there's just one electron going through the system at any one time. So when we detect these electrons, we only ever see one electron. And we see the electron at some point or other, okay? And so here we've seen electrons building up, electrons building up, electrons building up. And I'm going to leave that running, and I'm going to start this one over here, which is from Alan Aspe's group in Orsay, at the Laboratoire Charles Fabre. And so this is done exactly the same as for these electrons, but now with light, with the intensity of the light turned down so low that you only get one photon in the system at a time. So there's only one particle of light going through this system at any one time. There's only one electron going through this system at any one time. Oh, okay, and so here we've started that off for the photons, and you can see you get exactly the same interference pattern. So this is freaky, right? This is the crux of what is strange about quantum mechanics, because you saw every individual spot associated with one electron. But ultimately, if we wait long enough, those electrons build up an interference pattern. So they've got a wave-like property that ultimately determines the distribution of those dots, but each dot occurs individually. Okay, so there's a particle-like property. We detect a particle, but there's a wave-like property because we get an interference pattern. So, and here, the same thing. If in principle, so if I go back, like that experiment, I've got one source here, one source here, I get a diffraction pattern on here, but I'm building up one electron at a time or one photon at a time. If I place some detector at one of these slits or the other, or at one mirror or the other, a way of doing this might be to take mirrors, like I've got in this Michelson, and make the mirrors so light that the momentum of the light hitting and bouncing off it was enough for me to start detecting whether the photon went one way or the other. As soon as I can detect which way the photon went or which way the electron went, the interference pattern goes away, and they behave purely like particles that were either here or here. All of the interference is actually in this term here, if I look at the maths, but don't worry about that. This just gives me the probability that it went through slit A, the probability it went through slit B. This is some sort of interference pattern that builds up here. And the interpretation is due to Max Born, that there's a probability, the wave bit interprets the probability of where I'm going to end up. So where do I find the photon? Where do I find the electron? The wave bit gives me the probability of finding the particle there. But when I make an observation, I only ever find one particle, one photon, or one electron. I get a click at my detector. Okay? So the detection is a particle. I detect a particle. Whenever I make the detection, I detect a particle. But the probability of where I find that particle is determined by the wave-like properties. Okay. All right. I realize that I'm running out of time, so I'm going to move a bit faster. But another consequence of this, a chap called Werner Heisenberg, 1927, he developed a description of this, a mechanics of this. Erwin Schrödinger developed a different form of description of this. Schrödinger, famous for his Schrödinger's cat. But Heisenberg developed something called matrix mechanics. Don't worry about this. But what he concluded was that there must be some fundamental limit on what sort of measurements we can make. And so, and we can see this from that relationship between momentum of a particle and its wavelength, okay? Because if I know the wavelength better and better, or like if the wavelength gets smaller and smaller of the particle, that wave, remember, determines sort of the probability of where I find it. So the wavelength sort of determines the uncertainty in the position of I can make one of those measurements, where I can find it. So if I make the uncertainty in where the thing is less and less and less, then I must have more and more uncertainty in what its momentum is. And so that's what he came up with. And he said there's a fundamental limit, an inherent uncertainty introduced by quantum mechanics, that the uncertainty in our momentum times the uncertainty in the position has always got to be greater than something that's related to Planck's constant. This is called h-bar. It's just Planck's constant divided by 2 pi for some reason or other. If I ever quit physics and open a bar, a pub, I'm going to call it the h-bar, I think. But anyway, Einstein was at this. This talk was actually also in Berlin in December, and Einstein was at it, and he went along and was asked afterwards about what Heisenberg had said. He said, "Marvelous what ideas these young people have these days, but I don't believe a word of it." So, going back to nature and nature's laws lay hidden, night, God said, let Newton be, and all was light. So Alexander Pope, buried very close to Newton, actually, in Westminster Abbey. It did not last, the devil shouting, ho, let Einstein be, restored the status quo. It shouldn't be Einstein, it should be Heisenberg, right? But uncertainty, intrinsic uncertainty, is introduced into quantum mechanics. So this is Sir John Colling Squire. So there's something inherently strange about our measurement, right? When we make a measurement, we get a well-defined particle, okay, on the screen, the electrons or the photons. Interestingly, those electrons, that's sort of electron diffraction. You're treating the electrons as waves there to build up that wave pattern. J.J. Thomson invented the electron in 1897 and got the Nobel Prize for that to explain cathode rays coming from, just as in the photoelectric effect. His son, George, got the Nobel Prize for proving that electrons were waves. It was kind of interesting father and son relationship there. Okay, there's something called the measurement problem, and this... I was told I had to say something that was controversial. So, this is a painting that was done as part of the Art and Light Project. I'm glad to see Peter Stoffels is here, who organized our Art and Light Project last year. I worked with Holly Aitchison and Becky Cameron. I worked with Holly on this, and there was supposed to be lots of sort of interpretation and about this. I don't want to go into the details of what everything in here represents. Music, though, was like our physics is a representation of music. So the mathematics, the way we describe physics, is a representation of the real world, just as the same as the music score is a representation of music. But I would like to argue that physics is not the music, all right? The score is not music. And physics, the theoretical physics that we have, is a description of nature. It is actually a theory of measurement. And it is not the reality. It's not the objective reality around us. It's a theory about what I perceive to be an objective reality. I wish Alan Musgrave was here, we could have a longer discussion. But this is the key, I think, to this idea of measurement problem. And so this, I'm talking to my colleagues, really. What I want to say about the measurement problem is that there isn't one. And my reason for this is that there's been a discussion in quantum mechanics about you've got this wave function that describes the probability of finding a particle, and then you find it somewhere. So you've got a collapse of the wave function. The wave function used to describe a probability of finding a particle over some distance, and then you found it. And so now it can only be there. The wave function has to go from being this broad thing to this thing that's just instantaneously just here. And what I would say is that the wave function is not reality. The wave function is our description of reality. And so, although it's not statistical information that... once you start falling down this route of thinking it's just a lack of our information, in that sense, you get into trouble. But really, the essence of the wave function is not something that I think of as an objective part of reality. It's the particle itself, the measurement, that is always the reality. And I think we've got caught up in thinking Newton's laws really are what's out there as reality, and that's not true, right? The world is much more complex, much more rich, and particles and waves are just extremes of the possible things that exist. And I think we can get caught up in thinking that our theories are actually the objective reality, and I actually don't think they are. So quantum mechanics is a theory of measurement, as is all physics, as is perhaps all science, okay? The problem, I think, is that we take classical physics far too seriously. So I guess I've got about 10 minutes left. So I want to go on to talk about some of the things that are dear to our hearts and my heart here in physics. And so I want to talk about getting stuff really cold, because that's what a lot of Otago physics is about. We said about this uncertainty principle that the the uncertainty in position gets bigger if the uncertainty in momentum gets smaller. Now, if I think of the wave function for the nitrogen in this room, the wave function is tiny compared to how far apart the nitrogen molecules are in this room. So the particles of nitrogen in this room behave like classical particles. They don't know that they've got any wave-like properties, so they bounce around like little billiard balls. But if I make them colder, I know the momentum more, so I can't know their position, so the wavelength has to get bigger. And eventually, the waves start to overlap. And once they start to overlap, they realize they're quantum mechanical beasts, and then they can do lots of fun stuff, including forming Bose-Einstein condensates, which is something that Einstein predicted, that if you take certain types of these waves, bosons, then a separation is effected. One part condenses, the rest remains an ideal saturated gas. You can make a Bose-Einstein condensate. This is a picture of the first Bose-Einstein condensate in the Southern Hemisphere, made here in the Department of Physics at Otago by Andrew Wilson. How do you get down to these ridiculously low temperatures to do this? This is about 10 to the minus 7 Kelvin. So this is about 100 billionths of a degree Kelvin above absolute zero. So it's kind of cold. So let's try and put that in perspective. And so the surface of the sun is a warm 6,000 degrees, all right, there or thereabouts. The mean summer high in Dunedin is about 290 Kelvin, so it's about 17 degrees C. And the lowest ever recorded temperature at Vostok was 184 Kelvin. Here's some liquid nitrogen. So liquid nitrogen, what does cold mean, right? So this chap was visiting recently. He's been here a while, a number of times, Bill Phillips. He got the Nobel Prize for laser cooling. So how do you cool stuff? You cool stuff by making stuff slower. Temperature is just moving around. So I've got in here some liquid nitrogen, right? So I can just put the balloon in there. And so the air starts moving around less and less, right? So when the air's moving around less and less, it exerts less pressure, so the balloon should collapse, right? So here's the balloon, right? So after I put it in the liquid nitrogen, and actually I put another one in there, so I got a few of these. All right. Now, there's a chemist. All right. Oh, sorry. Now, we know that PV is... I'll do it in chemistry speak. PV is nRT, okay? The pressure times the volume is equal to number of moles times the molar gas constant times the temperature, right? The temperature's gone down to about 70 Kelvin, okay, and the room temperature is 290, so that's about a third of that, maybe a bit more, quarter of that. Why do the balloons collapse completely? Why don't the balloons just go down to a quarter of the size they should have been? So that's a question for the physicists in the audience and the chemists. All right, and we'll come back to that in a minute. So this is liquid nitrogen. I just want an excuse to play with that. So liquid nitrogen liquefies at 77 Kelvin. The coldest point in the universe is about 3 Kelvin, okay? That's the remnants of the microwave background. In the coldest part of the universe, helium becomes a superfluid at about 2 Kelvin. Now, superfluids are really cool, no pun intended, but this is intrinsically related to what we do. And so I'm just going to... We talk about these Bose-Einstein condensates, and we're interested in them because they become essentially superfluid. So here's a superfluid, but this superfluid is actually a superconductor. This is a high-temperature superconductor, and I'm just going to cool it down with some liquid nitrogen. This stuff won't hurt you. It's fine. So here, I've got some superconductor here, and so once it becomes cold enough, the current flows without any dissipation whatsoever. And now I've got something here that's not a superconductor, just to show you what I'm expecting to happen. If I take a piece... This is just a piece of dielectric, just a piece of plastic. If I drop it through here, it just falls out the bottom, right? But if I take a magnet and drop it through here, then it takes quite a while to fall out the bottom. These are exactly the same size. I've got the same material around the outside. It's not friction. It's nothing to do with that. This is magnet. Awkward giving things. this magnet drops through slowly because as the magnet drops, it induces a current in the metal. The metal little loop of current exerts a magnetic field which opposes the magnet and stops falling down. And so gradually, gradually the magnet drops out of the bottom because the current in this dies away. I could break that current. Wrong one, that one. This is the magnet. If I make holes in it so the current doesn't flow, then it goes through quicker. All right? Now, with my superconductor, the current never dies away. So if I go over here, hopefully you can see this. Can you see that? So it levitates above it, and it never falls through. And as long as I kept this below its critical temperature to make it a superconductor, it would never fall through. But that's kind of boring. So let's do it the other way around. And it's Marty McFly year, right? So, you know, 21st of October. Did anyone see him? I didn't even see the DeLorean. Anyway, unfortunately, I do have Marty McFly, but the hot glue gluing him to the superconductor broke when I put it in the liquid nitrogen. So I would like to thank Marty McFly, though. I'd like to thank Matthew McCaig, who actually, the cool thing about this is that he actually 3D printed Marty McFly on the 3D printer he made at home. And so I think that's very cool. So well done, Matt, and I'm sorry I can't use it. But I still have the base, if I can find it. Get it out. So this was, well, press it down so it doesn't fall off, but so I think that's pretty cool, all right? So and so there's a little, where is it? Oh, it's gone all the way over there. So, and for the mathematicians in the audience, it's also a Mobius strip, right? So it's only got one side. There was a difficulty associated with that. Andrew, at the museum, and so Andrew Charlton was the guy who, where is it? I just don't want to fall on the floor. Andrew made this at the Otago Museum. The Otago Museum and the Dobb Wall Centre in particular have had a wonderful relationship in doing some education and outreach, and I really do appreciate the... we're still floating there, by the way, look. So, very quickly, Andrew spent quite a lot of time putting this together. And you'll notice there are three rows of magnets, and there are only two rows of magnets here. That's fine if you make a disc. Once you turn it over, three ain't gonna work. So Andrew did very well to actually figure this out and eventually get it to work. I'm sorry, I'm gonna skip over that. But Andrew, I'm hoping he's here. Oh yeah. Andrew, thank you very much. You did a wonderful job. So I'm a theorist, so I can do these simple demonstrations. I realize I'm very close to running out of time. But how do you do these in the lab? How do you make a Bose-Einstein condensate? Well, that's a little bit harder. And so this is Niels Kiergaard's lab. So wonderful experimental group in at Otago. And so this is the optics. Can we see that? This is the optics for his rubidium-87. So this is a Bose-Einstein condensate. So this goes down to about 150 nanokelvin. Here is the experimental setup for his degenerate Fermi gas. These are different flavor of particles, which I'm not going to get to talk about. But very, very challenging experiments. And this is an experimentally driven field. So I would say I love being a theorist who's been driven by curiosity. But it's really the experiments that actually drive what's going on in our field. And I am very, very lucky to be in a department with such good people. Okay. So I was going to talk about some of the stuff I do. I'm interested in dynamics of Bose-Einstein condensates. Here were some simulations I took of two elongated condensates. Actually, they're more like the aspect ratio of there. When they collide and they make interference patterns, you can do measurements with these and make atom interferometers. You can make gyroscopes out of them. You can, in principle, make navigation systems that are much smaller than laser-based gyroscopes that we have at the moment. And I've done other stuff on looking at two-dimensional systems. I was interested in something called the Kostelitz-Thouless transition. There's funny things happen in two dimensions that don't happen in three dimensions. And so I've been able to go and away and do simulations and learn about quantum mechanics in flatland. I've been able to learn about Anderson localization, which is a phenomenon that waves get localized in certain material. And so I was interested in that, so I've been able to go away and learn about that. A lot of this is very esoteric. But as I say, it's backed up by these experiments. And they're all part of a continuum that we've captured in the Dobb Wall Center. And I'll stop shortly. But one thing that sold the Dobb Wall Center to government was that, if we think about what we want to do in this country, do we really want to sell milk powder at $4 a kilo, right, or whatever it is? So these are instruments made by Southern Photonics, which is a company that's spun out of, out of Auckland, I'm afraid, not one of the Otago ones, but they make these, one's a fiber laser, this is a network analyzer, but these sell for about $10,000 a kilo, $20,000 a kilo. Gold sells for $40,000 a kilo. If we can build an economy on this, it doesn't matter that we live miles away from anywhere, right? We don't have to worry. We can send this by FedEx, all right? So, and the other thing is, we don't have to do all the work here. So this is the SS Dunedin, which revolutionized New Zealand, okay? This was the first refrigerated ship, okay? It's a sailing ship, okay? There's a smokestack on here, but that was just to power the refrigeration. So in 1824, this is Sadi Carnot, and this is Kelvin. So they basically worked out thermodynamics in 1824. This ship sailed in 1882. In that time, that sort of time frame, what, 50 years, to go from inventing thermodynamics, really underpinning technology for the steam engine, for the Industrial Revolution, then we went to a refrigerated ship that could take meat from the Southern Hemisphere across the equator to London and sell it in London. They've been trying to do this from North America, where they sailed up into the Arctic and put meat on ice, and they had a reasonable success rate. No one had been able to cross the equator. Okay? The people who built this didn't invent thermodynamics, but they were good engineers. They were refrigeration engineers and steam engine engineers. And they could take this technology and they could build this ship. They could retrofit this ship to be a refrigerating ship. Unfortunately, on its second voyage, it sank. But it was a sailing ship, right? It wasn't a steamship. It wasn't... that wasn't the engineer's fault. But you had to have the skills to take up the technology that was being developed around the world. And that's one of the most important things, I think, about the Dobb Wall Center, is that we're training people. And to train the top people in the world, we have to be doing top quality research. And so it's the fun stuff being led by curiosity. It's not going to kill what we're doing. It's actually what gives the lifeblood to what we're doing. And so that's really where I want to end my talk, is on the Dobb Wall Center. And the wonderful things that I think the people around me are achieving, and I'm really honored to be part of this. And I'm not going to name everyone here who's been part of that journey, but it's been a wonderful journey, and I'm very, very proud to be part of the University of Otago, which is an incredible place to work. And I hope I've left some of you confused. Thank you. Do you want me to sit down?
If you would please.
Yes, boss.
Good evening. My name's Blair Blakey. And it's my great pleasure as the current acting head of physics to respond to this really great lecture we've had tonight. So thank you, David, for a marvellous lecture. Tonight, David gently introduced us to the deep and profound theory of quantum mechanics. He charted a course that took us past some prominent aspects of the theory, supported by key experiments. Quantum theory challenges our understanding of the world, our almost instinctual attachment to determinism, and even our most basic concepts of reality. Niels Bohr once said, "If quantum mechanics hasn't profoundly shocked you, then you haven't understood it yet." Tonight, I hope that the non-physicists were shocked, and perhaps even some of the physicists were reminded of the beautiful counterintuitive theory that we have the pleasure of playing with all the time. But if you did have some trouble understanding, as David alluded to, and perhaps did not understand all the aspects of the presentation tonight, don't feel bad. Feynman once said, "I think I can safely say that nobody understands quantum mechanics." So you're in good company. David's presentation was nicely broken by experimental demonstrations. This is a very bold thing because, like myself, David is a theorist, and we have a reputation for running into trouble when we try and do experiments. So, David, thank you for preparing such an entertaining and clear presentation of many things to show the points you're trying to get across. I'd also like to take some time to perhaps share a few observations about David, being one of his lucky to be one of his colleagues. So I have a few points I'd like to share. My first observation about David is David is not scared of people. Now, I know this sounds a little bit weird, but we are a physics department. And this is a very nice aspect of David. He enjoys working with people. He seeks a greater good through collaboration. And for this reason, he is always eager to participate in activities in the department, the division, and the wider university and beyond. And as we heard from the Vice-Chancellor and the Pro-Vice-Chancellor, David has an impressive array of service contributions and is a natural leader. Indeed, he has found his calling, I would say, as the leader of the Dodd Wall Centre, which is one of the largest funded activities to ever be based, research activities to be based at Otago. My second observation, which would also be clear from the talk tonight, is that David is a diverse physicist and a true scholar. Physics these days is a highly specialised subject, and most physicists are forced to flow into a narrow area of research and stay there. David has resisted this. His research interests include fields such as condensed matter physics, atomic physics, statistical and quantum physics, and more broadly into areas such as plasma physics, astronomy, cosmology, high energy physics, and even outside of physics, to areas such as mathematics, philosophy, as would have been clear, and economics. And I would like to note that somehow he managed to complete a philosophy degree while apparently being a busy academic at Otago. David takes this passion and curiosity, and I guess it's become clear that the cat David was referring to was curious, was in fact David. So David is really just a big pussy cat. But he takes that passion he has for research into teaching, has a can-do attitude for teaching, and David's always enthusiastic to try teaching something right outside of his area and background of interest. My last observation about David is a person who never wants to miss an opportunity. No matter how much David has got on, he never fails to get those grants in. Notice I didn't say on time. He's also never wants to miss championing an idea that's too good to let slip by. So because of this, David is often overcommitted. He sacrifices his personal time to see things through to completion. And so, of course, to his family, Denise, Calvin and Nancy, thanks for letting us have so much of David. So I will wrap up now, so you probably don't want to hear any more from me. But I'd like to thank the audience for attending tonight at this very late stage of the year and extend an invite for the audience to join us, the academic party, afterwards for some refreshments upstairs at the staff club. And finally, just once again, David, thank you for your contribution to physics, the Department of Physics, and for a delightful talk. And we have a little something for appreciation. So.
I just have to ask one more thing. So did any of the chemists or other people in the audience figure out why the balloons collapse? Pardon? No. So what else is in air? The oxygen liquefies. So the oxygen liquefies at 90 Kelvin, and nitrogen dissolves in oxygen. And so once the oxygen is liquefied in the balloon, the nitrogen dissolves in the oxygen, and that's why they collapse. All right.